You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, another chemical attack in Syria. The world decries it, the obvious suspects deny it. Will it change anything? My guests John Everard and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Russia's naming of the perpetrator of yesterday's metro bombing in St. Petersburg, Xi Jinping's imminent arrival at Mar-a-Lago, and the Los Angeles Times serialized op-ed indictment of President Donald Trump. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are John Everard, former UK ambassador to North Korea, among other postings, and Michael Goldfarb, the journalist and broadcaster. Both have books freely available. I feel I should mention that as a gesture of solidarity with my guests. We will start this evening in Syria, where at least 58 people, some estimates run into triple figures, have been killed in what appears to have been a chemical attack on a rebel-held town in the country's northwest. Clinics treating the casualties, which included many children in Khan Sehun, were subsequently struck by air-to-surface rockets. As is traditional in such circumstances, Syria denied possessing any such weapons and Russia denied carrying out any airstrikes in the vicinity. Michael, first of all, Russia and Syria deny everything. Somebody did this, however, and it is kind of difficult to imagine who else it might have been. But from the point of view of whoever it was, what would be the imaginable point?
I think that it probably has to do with, and it's nothing that can be proven, but it's a reasonable surmise. A couple of days ago, the Trump administration made it clear, Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, who actually has supplanted Rex Tillerson as the real voice of American foreign policy, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, made it clear that the U.S. now has no problem with Assad staying in power. And I think that that might well have cued up this attack, or, you know, a renewed harsh measures against the remaining pockets of resistance to the Assad regime. So I think that's where that's coming from. And as for what the Trump administration's initial response was, Sean Spicer, the press secretary in today's briefing, blamed it all on Obama and, you know, said it was because of the weakness of the previous administration that Assad felt emboldened to reutilize some kind of poison gas on his own people.
I want to come back to that that position of Spicer's shortly, but another thing that Sean Spicer said, John Everard, was that this attack cannot be ignored by the civilized world. It will be, though, won't it?
Yes, of course. I mean, like so much that's coming out of the Trump administration, you have to sort of insert knots and take away knots wherever they come through. The opposite. This is the Trump administration saying, we're going to wring our hands and life will go on. It is a shocking attack. It is inhumane attack. I mean, I don't think anybody can watch the video of what happened to those children and remain unmoved. It was also, let's be clear, a completely unnecessary attack. I mean, Assad is winning the military war. He didn't need to do this.
Well, this was why I was wondering, what's the point?
Yes, that's the question on everybody's mind. Why has he done this? It carries a high risk for him. It may be that just once, you know, for once, the international community does rally around and he faces Security Council action and, you know, general inconvenience of that kind. He could probably have achieved his military objectives using other types of weaponry. He's got any number of high explosive bombs he could have dropped on these people. Why use sarin?
Michael, as you pointed out, Sean Spicer did say he did the blame Obama thing. His precise line was that it was a consequence of the past administration's weakness and irresolution. Now, this is a crass moment at which to make such an observation, obviously, scoring political points off the backs of several dozen people who've been gassed to death. Is he actually entirely wrong?
No, that's the sad thing. I mean, on this one, it's moot, isn't it? But if three or four years ago now, it's been going on for so long in Syria, if President Obama had stood by this idea of a red line.
August 2013, the chemical attack in Ghouta was when the red line was breached.
Exactly. So three quarter years ago. Then we might not be in this situation today, but I think it's moot because the complexities of the situation in Syria, which is one of the reasons why the war continues, made it an incredibly difficult call. And if you're going to work blame out, you could also say that David Cameron possibly has some responsibility since he failed to bring the House of Commons along with him in that vote. Ed Miliband prevailed, and without Britain by America's side in a substantial, military, it wouldn't have been retaliation, but a military statement about using this, if Obama had done that, it was very hard for him to go in alone, and so it didn't happen. And so Spicer points out something that perhaps liberals might not want to remember, but there you have it.
I mean, John, to return, to stick with that idea of the red line and Ghouta in August 2013, I mean, there's a lot of blame to go around in Syria, obviously, and you can hypothesize until the end of time with historical counterfactuals. But how different might the world be if that red line had turned out to be a red line, if Obama had reacted by, for example, acting to destroy Syria's air force and any surface-to-air capacity it had or air-to-surface capacity it had to establish safe zones for Syrian civilians? That would, of course, have forestalled Russia's intervention in Syria. It might have stop the refugee exflows from Syria. You could argue that it forestalls Donald Trump and Brexit.
Yes, you could also argue that it would have triggered a much tougher Syrian government action. It might actually have caused panic in Moscow, brought the Russians in earlier, not necessarily forestalling them, and bringing Russian forces directly into contact with United States forces. It could have actually not saved the world, but given us a much better outcome, but it could equally have gone horribly wrong. Of course, we'll never know, but I think it's worth reflecting that it will not have been a decision that President Obama took lightly. He will have pondered different outcomes and different probabilities with extreme care and surrounded by some very clever people. He clearly decided that it was not worth the risk. I hesitate against him.
Yeah, and the thing is, in bringing up extreme care and the number of qualified people around providing input into that very lonely decision, that is the big difference between the current administration and the Obama administration, because it is not possible to imagine people carefully presenting options to a president who's already well briefed, because we know he's not, and that the people who he listens to most closely, like Steve Bannon, actually probably regard today's casualties as, the cost of doing business when you're trying to eliminate all forms of jihadism. And we read today in the Washington Post, and the thing is that somewhere along the line, these things will connect up, that Eric Prince, the founder of the notorious mercenary firm Blackwater, who now lives in the UAE and runs a successor company, has become a back channel to the Russians. And you wonder what messages are being passed through this back channel about, well, if you do this, we're all on the road against jihadism. And, we can't be too careful or too, bleeding heart in obeying rules when we engage with people like this. And you wonder if these messages get passed along to the Russians, who then, in conversations with the Syrians, and all of this comes together with a sense that, as you said, Andrew, there's no point in, if you want to kill people, you don't have to use gas. I mean, there are other ways to kill people. There's other ways to crush this continuing rebellion. But if you get the sense that, well, this administration doesn't care anymore, then, the gloves come off and you have this.
Well, let's move along now and look at Russia, where we are somewhat the wiser about the perpetrator of yesterday's bombing of a St. Petersburg metro train, which killed 14 people and injured at least 50. A suspected suicide bomber has been named as 22-year-old sushi chef Akhbazon Jalilov, a Russian citizen of Kyrgyz descent. Russian investigators also named Jalilov as the person responsible for leaving another device at a different station. This was found and rendered safe. grave. John, there's still no claim of responsibility from anybody, not even the sort of phoned-in opportunist one from Islamic State, which we did have relatively quickly after the other week's attack at Westminster. Is this strange?
This is very strange. And normally Islamic State are very fast out of the blocks to claim responsibility for anything with which they have the remotest connection. Their silence is deafening. And it may be that this man was acting alone, a personal grudge, his own...
But that does seem to have been the case at Westminster a couple of weeks ago as well. Such connections as there are between the perpetrator of that attack and Islamic State seem extremely tenuous.
Yes, but there were nevertheless some links. He was radicalised in prison, we understand, by somebody who'd had quite distinct links with Islamic State. And there's also the mysterious phone call 2 minutes before he revved up his car and started mowing down people on that bridge. Here, we don't know what links there might have been, but Islamic State says he's claimed none. Nor has anybody else. You know, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, silence all round. What on earth is going on?
Well, just thinking about it, and this, just me speculating, is that it's possible that Islamic State social media types may be otherwise engaged in Mosul and in the area around Raqqa where there is fighting, and it just may be that the news is a little bit slower getting to them. I mean, that's just a hypothesis, because they are under some pressure, IS is certainly. But I don't know. It's only been 24, 36 hours. And, you know, the idea that there is self-radicalization, or that there's been a fairly steady stream of propaganda coming out of IS about do it yourselves. You know, you may not be able to join us in Syria, but you can carry the fight too, the Crusaders or whatever. And actually, I've been a little surprised that given the extreme activity of Russia in Syria, that there hasn't been blowback yet. So this would just be the first incident, and I would have expected it to come a year ago, so it may just be more difficult to get these things planned and executed in Russia now.
On that subject, John, is it potentially, I speak as one of those sort of personal responsibility cranks who doesn't buy so much into the blowback narrative. I think, you know, what people do is entirely on them. But is it potentially politically difficult for Vladimir Putin if this attack is perceived as a response to Russia's intervention in Syria?
Yes, it is. It will. I mean, I don't think there is massive public support for the Russian intervention in Syria. For other aspects of Vladimir Putin, perhaps there is. But I think a lot of Russians are starting to see Syria as just another war costing good Russian lives and good Russian money. So difficult anyway, and this will make it more unpopular. It will be much more difficult if there is any kind of repeat attack. Putin has come out very strongly condemning the attack. Well, of course he had to, and indicating that it's going to be a crackdown, and you know that the Oman will start charging around and preventing it. If, despite all that, somebody manages to detonate another bomb, then Putin starts to look not quite as strong as he once was, and perhaps not quite as effective. And he really can't afford that.
I mean, Michael, do you think people in Russia have been relatively patient with the intervention in Syria? Because so far as we know, at least, Russian casualties have been fairly low, given the amount of time they've been there and the amount of activity they've been involved in there. This has not been a rerun of Afghanistan.
Well, I mean, I don't know how the Russian media is playing these things, and I'm not entirely sure how to answer. I know that they have very successfully put up a propaganda screen about jihadists actually, you know, putting out fake videos of children in the white helmets, you know, being a front for Al-Qaeda. And perhaps public opinion is willing to cut Vladimir Putin a break. But I'm really not sure how to answer that one, Andrew. I just don't know, unless you read the Russian media on a regular basis in Russian, it's hard to have a real good handle on that.
I mean, John, returning to the perpetrator, about whom we have learned a fair bit, given what we've also learned about the perpetrators of similar attacks elsewhere in recent years, not just here in London the other week, although he was a bit of an outlier because of his age, but elsewhere in Berlin, in Nice, in far too many other places, Orlando also springs to mind, how much are we willing to bet against us finding out this guy was basically a none too bright, unemployable stoner with a history of petty criminality and violence towards women?
I would put my money in exactly the opposite direction. Yes, this is likely to be just what emerges from the investigation. As you say, a pattern is emerging, similarities between all these killers. Doubtless partly because those are the kinds of individuals that the radicalizers, the, both IS and now all the other Islamic movements, look for. They are looking for losers. They are looking for people who are dissatisfied with their lot. They cannot afford to try to radicalize people who are particularly intelligent. And so a profile emerges. Sad but true.
And Michael, further on that thought, this is, I admit, a pet theory of mine, which may be as riddled with holes as all my other pet theories about absolutely everything. But have we been focused, the last 15 years in particular, since 2001, too much on the Islamist aspect of what makes these people up? Is it actually more a deficiency among young men, or is it a drug problem? Is it a mental health problem?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that, Andrew, because 2 weekends ago, I was at a conference in Bulgaria, of all places, with a bunch of community workers who work in the Muslim community. And it was just after the incident on Westminster Bridge. And boy, Muslims know that very often these are converts. You know, they just said, another convert. Someone who isn't born into it, someone who has their own problems that they bring into the religion. And I think that, you know, perhaps, a better place for police work to go would be to, you know, be checking out people who have done prison time for, you know, the kind of violent petty crimes, aggravated assault, wife beating, whatever. And check out if they've recently converted. That might be a better way to understand the community and understand what's going on with jihadism, which isn't to say that there isn't, across the Middle East and into Central Asia, a large group of young men who do want to fight and do want to fight for this ideology. But in the West, I do think it is a very different phenomenon.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with John Everard and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, President Xi Jinping packs for Florida.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are John Everard and Michael Goldfarb. Now, President Xi Jinping of China will later this week be welcomed to Mar-a-Lago, the Florida golf club from which the free world is presently governed. While it's hard to imagine any meeting involving President Donald Trump and a grown-up which isn't a clash of personalities, this one seems likely to be more so than most. Xi is a proverbially cautious and considered politician. However, there shouldn't be a shortage of conversation starters, most notably Trump's recent threat and or promise to sort North Korea out, heedless of Chinese cooperation. John, first of all, is there any chance, do we think, of some unlikely odd couple rapport emerging from this?
Sends my blood running cold. I mean, I can take a complete fiasco breakdown of talks, but sort of Donald Trump and Xi Jinping hitting it off, becoming great buddies. Yeah, can I immigrate to the planet Mars, please? I mean, Xi is a consummate politician. You don't get to where he's got to without a certain array of political skills, and he will be looking to charm Donald Trump, flattering him, playing to his vanity. I mean, people who work with Donald Trump have indicated that actually his buttons are fairly obvious and he does respond to having them pressed. How Donald Trump will play with President Xi, who knows? I wonder whether Donald Trump knows himself yet. He's only got a foot couple of days to go, but he probably hasn't got much of a plan. As for great rapport, buddy building, I'm not counting on it, to be honest. I suspect that if Donald Trump did get too warm, that President Xi, just to protect his own political position, might start backing off just a bit.
Well, on that, Michael, this is a tricky one for the Chinese president, isn't it? Because how does he play this for domestic consumption back home?
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, it depends. The comments that Donald Trump made in his interview with the Financial Times, he said, we're going to go it alone. You know, I mean, sometimes...
This was vis-a-vis North Korea.
Vis-a-vis North Korea. And it was, but the remarks were aimed at the Chinese in advance. You know, we're tired of, you know, going at your glacial pace. You know, 200 years from now, we'll still be discussing North Korea and deciding whether, you know, the French Revolution at 400 is a success or not. That doesn't work. There is comment, you know, I mean, is this possibly cutting the Gordian knot? Okay, we're just going to tell the North Koreans that's it. We're at the end of our patience. It's not the way China works. I don't imagine that the Chinese understand it. What I imagine, actually, is that other than those who might want to get in on some of the business that with the Trump family, that most Chinese are probably indulging in their extraordinarily nationalistic worldview and saying, we really are better than the United States now. And look at what a fool and a clown they've got running them. And when they see the pictures from Mar-a-Lago, God, I mean... I don't know. It's while John was talking, I was thinking of those famous snaps from people's iPhones from the ordinary punters who pay $200,000 a year to belong to Mar-a-Lago. If there's another North Korean missile launch over the weekend, just as when Shinzo Abe was there, playing
and frankly, if the North Koreans have a sense of humor, there will be.
You'll see. There's Xi. I'm going to say. Tell me how I say that again.
Xi Jinping.
And Donald Trump, you know, having dinner and kind of like having a briefing in the middle of this very public space, no situation room to retreat to, and, you know, the golf course is out the back if they need to get rid of their tension. It's insane.
Well, on the golf issue, John, there is a protocol problem here, isn't there? Because President Trump is a big fan of golf, whereas President Xi has made a crusade against golf a motif of his presidency, which is for which I cannot applaud him enough, frankly.
Well, yes, I've long taken the view that golf is just God's way of telling you you've got far too much free time on your hands. But yes, if he's invited out for a game of golf in front of the cameras, he might wince, rather. This is not going to play that well.
I mean, but that
home.
Can't possibly happen, can it? I mean, I've spoken to people who have interacted with the forward teams of Chinese officialdom, as I'm sure you have as well. They are choreographed down to the second and the last dot on the last I and the last cross on the last T, or whatever the Chinese character equivalents of those are.
That was before Donald Trump was invented. I mean, if Donald Trump just gets bored with these long words and difficult issues and says, hey, let's go and play a round of golf, what's he going to do?
But Xi would be missing a chance for one-upmanship because Trump, as you know, can't walk 18 holes. Xi looks very fit to me, and he could just sort of walk them and see it as a chance for one-upmanship, subtle one-upmanship. And while President Trump rides around in his cart, you know, Xi can just be striding slowly alongside, making conversation through his translator, and you could see that picture would work as well about a vigorous leader against an old fat one.
Kennedy who refused to wear an overcoat in Moscow?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
It was Kennedy, wasn't it? I'm remembering that one right. There was a U.S. president who made a big thing of not wearing an overcoat in Moscow.
His hat, he didn't. And it was freezing
Kennedy
cold.
Kennedy never wore a hat, though.
At the inauguration, and it killed
haberdashers. Kennedy is credited as single-handedly destroying haberdashery in the United States. We appear to be deviating from the point somewhat. Finally tonight, however, we will stay with President Donald Trump because we have remarked more than once in this forum upon his dogged, if inadvertent, campaign to single-handedly revive American liberal journalism and civic society. His outbursts against the New York Times, the ACLU, and several individual authors and journalists have been lottery wins for those on the receiving end. A reminder that all three of us here gathered do have books available if you're listening, Mr. President. The Los Angeles Times appears to have decided that it fancies a piece of this action. All this week, it has been running a serialized op-ed outlining Trump's manifold deficiencies. Part three, Trump's authoritarian vision, runs today. John, have we learned? I mean, hugely entertaining though this is. Are we learning anything we didn't already know?
No, but we are having it set out in nice, lucid prose in a systematic way. It's bringing together sort of bits and pieces that have been floating around, that have been causing irritation for a long time now, but all in one place, a kind of almost a prosecution document. You know, this is what is wrong with your presidency, Mr. President. And the implicit question, of course, is what are you going to do about it?
Michael, does it matter? I mean, Trump famously won the presidency, endorsed, I think, by... Did any newspapers endorse him? I don't think... None of the big ones did.
No. Ronald Shimon did.
Which one?
Rodham Shimon, North Korea.
Apart from the always, always sought-after endorsement of the official newspaper of the Workers' Party of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Trump had almost no newspaper endorsement. So will getting a kicking every day in the op-ed pages of the Los Angeles Times matter?
No. And, you know, it's an exercise for your subscribers. And it's very well written. It has to be said. It's an extremely well written series. I mean, not all editorial writing reaches this kind of controlled fury.
Well, with one exception, I was struck by a very weird line in the first in the series, which was our dishonest president, which was they start the opening paragraph by saying, yes, we thought it'd be terrible, etc., etc. But then they say, still, nothing prepared us for the magnitude of this train wreck. Nothing? I mean, the man's first 70 years of existence?
Well, but, you know, there was a strong strain of wishful thinking in the American punditocracy that however he had campaigned, that the office and the pressures and the reality of the presidency would force a change on him. And of course, what we've learned is that he is such a sociopath that nothing external can change the internal workings of his mind. And that's an extraordinarily worrisome thing. I mean, my problem with the LA Times editorial series is that, and perhaps tomorrow in the final one, there is no prescription for what their readers can do to effectively constrain, make clear to the administration how displeased they are, and find some kind of strategy for what is potentially a very, very damaging series of months or years before he leaves office.
I mean, no punches are pulled. I mean, a line from the editorial describes him as so unpredictable, so reckless, so petulant, so full of blind self-regard, so untethered to reality that it's impossible to know where his presidency will lead or how much damage he will do to our nation. I mean, John, can minds still be changed about Donald Trump, do we think, especially by the Los Angeles Times? Are any Trump supporters going to pick this up and think, well, I hadn't thought of it like that?
I suspect that the core hardline Trump supporters, firstly, won't read the Los Angeles Times, and secondly, wouldn't be swayed by it even if they did. But there are people at the margins. There are people who are not dyed-in-the-wool Trump supporters who voted for him either because they thought he was a lesser evil than Hillary Clinton or because they thought the establishment needed a shake-up, and who might well be reading these editorials and scratching their heads and thinking, yes, these guys have got a point.
Michael, is it possible, returning to my earlier theory, that the LA Times are just baiting him, hoping for a bump in their subscriptions? Looking at Trump's Twitter feed earlier, he hasn't bitten yet.
No, I know. And I think that...
Which must be driving them nuts.
The LA Times editorial board. I wonder who stands up for them in the daily press conference. And just why not just ask Sean Spicer, hey, Sean, has the president been reading our editorials? Except that in America, the news side is completely divorced from the editorial side, allegedly.
That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Michael Goldfarb and John Everard, thank you both very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anthea Longo. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.